Today on Vox Talks Economics, how protests are born and why they die. Welcome to Vox Talks Economics from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name's Tim Phillips. Every week we bring you the best new research in economics. Remember, subscribe, follow us on Instagram as well. You heard there, protesters taking to the street to express their views on climate change, on Gaza, on immigration as well. And every year we see thousands of similar protests. And we also know that most of them are fueled by social media. It's easy for groups of like-minded people to find each other, express an opinion. It's also easy to make a date and a time to get together. But why do some protests flourish and persist and some disappear? And some remain peaceful, but others become violent. Benoît Schmutz-Bloch of Crest École Polytechnique is one of the authors of a new paper that develops and tests a model of the life cycle of protests. He joins me now. Benoît, welcome to Vox Talks Economics.
Hi, Tim. Thanks for having me.
Benoît, it seems to me, it seems to a lot of people, that there are many, many protests now. We have anti-immigration, Black Lives Matter, populism, climate. Are more people seeing protest as a way to create political change, or are we just more aware of these protests because we can literally watch them on our phones in real time?
There's definitely been a change in the way people learn about, take part and interact with protest movements. The development of social media has meant that most protests are now organized online, and instead of being led by unions or well-established organizations of the kind, protests are now much more likely to be organized in a decentralized manner. And so they may be also more salient because of that. The Arab Spring was one of the first examples of white protests, where social media played a huge role. But you can think of the Occupy Wall Street movement as another early example. And what is also striking is that the presence of social media also changes what it means to protest. For instance, instead of going to demonstrations, protesting increasingly means sharing content online.
We need to define our terms, and this is something that governments and the police are struggling with as well. What defines a protest? How do protests vary?
So, as you know, there's a lot of variation in the way people may decide to protest. Mm-hmm. Online messaging and the formation of online bubbles of discontent, sit-ins, marches, street riots, political revolutions, etc. So, as you can see from these examples, there's also a considerable variation in how intense and violent social unrest can be. But at the heart of the decision to protest, as always, I would argue, often something deeply emotional related to some form of discontent and the feeling of being unfairly treated. As such, it's not a traditional topic for economic analysis.
No.
Economists have not really clearly defined typology of protest movements. So political scientists have, sociologists have, maybe even anthropologists. In Econ, we like theory, and from a theoretical perspective, Econ can bring some insights. Protests are thought of as a coordination problem between various individuals who share a willingness to express their discontent. And protesting is going to be considered as individually costly, and it will only be worth it if others also partake. And this tension is at the heart of the analysis of when protests emerge and persist.
As you say, as sociologists, anthropologists, political scientists, they found protest movements to be interesting subjects for research for a long time now. So with this research that you're doing, what are you seeking to find out that we don't know already?
There's a lot of research showing that the availability of social media helps to kickstart protests, as it makes it easier to signal a willingness to protest. So in a sense, it makes it easier to infer if others around you are willing to protest as well. So that's one thing. But it also lowers coordination costs for protesters by making it easier to work out the details. How do we actually protest? Where and when? But in contrast, much less is known about how social media help or harm protest movements in the longer run. The main insights come from qualitative case studies still. Many were described in a famous book written by a sociologist, Twitter and Tear Gas, which, among other questions, gets to wonder whether the ability to organize massive protests, so I kind of quote, quickly on social media, so could be making those protests vulnerable in the long term. Uh-huh. And this is exactly what we are after in this project. But as often in economics, we kind of restrict the focus and we focus on one specific dimension of this very multifaceted question, the issue of protest violence. In the past, formal organizations such as parties or unions tended to have a disciplinary effect on protesters, as they know that violence may also discredit the protest. But nowadays, the fact that protests are so decentralized and organized online can make it harder for movements to deliver a coherent message and also to moderate their most radical members. And this is particularly true if we focus on how protests unfold, which is less studied than how they start. And this is something we spend quite a lot of time on in this project.
A related impact of social media is its influence on what news outlets choose to report. In October 2022, Juliette Cagier described a study of 2 billion social media messages and its astounding conclusions. Listen to the episode, How Social Media Influences the News.
Protests used to happen many years ago. The unions, political parties that used to run them. Has social media replaced that form of organization now?
A little bit, yes. I mean, social media are prevalent around the world, and as such, they can be found in one form or another in almost every protest movement today. Mm-hmm. It's not always at the source, though. Let me take an example kind of close to home. Last year, France, you may have heard of that, witnessed a week of pretty intense urban riots following the killing of a teenager by the police. Mm-hmm. And the rioters were very young, and the riots were quite spontaneous, I want to say. So it was not so much organized on social media, but TikTok was still widely used during the protests to post, for instance, self-promoting videos of looting in real time. But that said, we do observe that large protest movements today with a political stance usually rely on a social media infrastructure. Without this infrastructure, many protests are likely to remain stillborn and unobserved. And the theory of protest dynamics that we put forward in this project includes this feature on protest birth, but it also tries to understand subsequent stages of the protest life cycle.
Many people, they would support an online protest because it's really easy to do, but they wouldn't get up off the sofa and make the effort to go to the street to protest offline. What is the difference between a protest that stays online and one that creates enough momentum to become a demonstration?
Yes, you're right in that participating online is indeed less costly than participating in the streets. Mm-hmm. But arguably, it's also less effective in terms of policy impact still, even in our digital world. And so in our model, the goal, if we can call it like that, of the movement is to switch from online to the street or to offline, as we put it. And it's going to happen if a sufficiently large number of people have an incentive to pay the cost of offline participation. And this is going to be the case if the online interactions that happened before have made those people optimistic that the street protest will be massive. Everybody wants to join a widespread movement, or at least many people want to join a widespread movement, but no one wants to protest alone, especially in the street.
We also can see on the news that some protest movements become much more extreme over time. Why do protests become more radical or more violent?
This happens because there is a group of individuals, we assume, who are prone to radical action. Initially, those might stay peaceful because protesting violently only makes sense in the middle of a large group And no one knows for sure whether there are actually enough radicals to make it worthwhile to turn violent. But we argue that social media might help this fraction of individuals prone to radical action find each other and realize in some cases, not all, that many others share their view and their desire for a violent movement.
You still have those moderate protesters, people that have a point of view, but don't feel the same way as those more radical protesters who've been energized by this movement. What happens to them? And what happens to the original goals of the protest?
If the movement gets more violent, it might discourage moderate protesters from participating. Mm-hmm. This can happen for several reasons. The first is simply that protesting becomes actually physically dangerous, for instance, because of the confrontation between violent protesters and the police. It can also become more dangerous from a legal perspective. Moderates might also care about their reputation and not want to be identified with the most radical members of the movement. All these factors may prompt them to leave the movement if it becomes too violent for their taste. As for the original goals of the protest, it's true that the different factions may have different end goals, which is something that we abstract from.
What happens with most of these movements is that in the end, they fizzle out. Does this process explain why that happens?
Yes, that was a little bit why we started trying to think about a theory. Those that have no propensity for violence might simply leave the movement, and they will leave it in the hands of a small radical minority, maybe still very much energized, but whose action will not trigger any political change because it's too small. And this is where we believe our analysis yields an effect that sounds paradoxical at first, but which is probably at play in many cases. Social media will be a helpful coordination device for protest movements, but they can also seal the fate of a movement if they contribute to its radicalization and hence to the exclusion of the peaceful majority, whose participation is necessary for the movement to have political impact. Of course, you have other factors that are not included in our model and could very much contribute to the radicalization and the death of a movement. For example, the response of the police is very likely to be a key factor. And similarly, you can think that some governments may be smart about it and provide a kind of a carefully crafted response in terms of public policy that will be able to fracture the coalition of protesters. But those factors are not mutually exclusive, and they can all be relevant in some cases.
So you apply this model to the Yellow Vest movement, Gilets Jaunes movement in France, the famous wave of protests. Remind us about why they were protesting.
So the Yellow Vest movement happened 6 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, I still feel like it was yesterday, but then COVID happens. And I mean, it's not old news. I want to argue it's still active. So let's go back to the beginning. In May 2018, French motorists started an online petition against proposed increase in gas taxes. Mm-hmm. And this petition was almost dormant for many months. It initially gathered only a small number of signatures, didn't make a lot of noise, but kind of randomly at some point after a summer, it was shared on Facebook and then it spread nationwide. And in October, marketing genius posted a video online suggesting that angry drivers should use their yellow safety vest as a rallying sign. And all drivers are required by law to have a yellow jacket in their trunk. And so this symbol was very easy to adopt. After that, everything went very quickly. Local Facebook groups quickly developed to plan road blockades around the country, and it all happened on November 17, 2018. On that day, thousands of protests took place across the country, and they gathered between 300,000 and over 1 million demonstrators, according to sources. So it was super successful, kind of blocked a large part of France at first try. And following the success of this first offline event, protesters then decided to organize weekly protests every Saturday. And so this movement initially focused on high gas prices and kind of the quality of life and standard of living, but it quickly shifted to a broader criticism of government politics and policies.
We've slipped into describing this as a social media-inspired protest. But as an economist, can you be sure that it was social media that inspired the Gilets Jaunes protest?
So honestly, I think just as a newspaper reader, I can be sure that social media was instrumental because these demonstrations were mostly organized on Facebook groups all over France and in a couple of weeks. Without social media, such widespread demonstrations could not have been planned. The Yellow Vest movement gathered a very heterogeneous set of people across the country that could not have been able to coordinate through a well-established organization like a union. So in a sense, yes, I'm sure social media allowed them to meet and to coordinate. But as an economist, I can also run some statistical tests. We spend a lot of time in this project trying to make sure about that. We look, for instance, at the rollout of 4G networks that facilitated online mobilization, but to some extent happened randomly. And we checked that this rollout was then associated with higher levels of mobilization or higher probabilities of seeing street demonstrations. So yes, I'm pretty confident that social media initially caused these protests.
After the first wave of protests, which were stunning, they're on the news absolutely everywhere, how did the movement evolve? And again, economically, how can you measure how a movement like this evolves and changes?
Those first protests that made the news everywhere, they led to a surge in subsequent online mobilization. So this is something we can observe precisely with the data we collected. In a couple of days, hundreds of new Facebook groups were created across France. As our model implies, part of this, let's call it a rebound effect, may have been driven by the fact that this protest showed everyone how popular the movement was at the time, which is confirmed by polling data, for instance. However, after a couple of weeks, protests became increasingly violent and the movement gradually lost public support. We can see and measure this change of attitudes in the data that we collected. We scrapped and we analyzed hundreds of public Facebook pages that were used by the Yellow Vests. And during the first weeks of the movement, most comments were positive, welcoming, or encouraging. But a couple of weeks after the start of the movement, comments became increasingly violent and radical.
How do you measure the character of a Facebook post when there is this amount of data?
So we use something that's become quite standard in political economics, among other fields, that is natural language processing methods.
Yeah.
It's a field of computer science that's specifically dedicated to the processing of large amounts of textual documents with AI. And nowadays, it's possible, it's amazing, to process millions of Facebook posts on a personal laptop in less than an hour. In our case, we rely on several algorithms to better understand what the protesters talk about and how they talk about it. First, we identify the main topics that are discussed by protesters. Some topics are about organizational or economic concerns. Others are much more antagonistic and critical of the police and government officials. And the latter become much more common as the protests unfold. Similarly, we also measure the sentiment of the posts, and we observe that negative sentiments that come from kind of a dictionary approach with a list of words becomes increasingly prevalent over time. And one last type of measure we consider is based on a speech partisanship model that tries to guess the user's political affiliation based on the vocabulary that they use, once again. So the way it works is you train a model, for instance, on another speech corpus, for instance, from tweets from parliamentarians whose political affiliation you know, and then you use this model to predict the political affiliation of the discussant on Facebook. And we observe that online posts are increasingly likely to be classified as stemming from far-right or far-left partisans over time.
This seems to fit your model pretty well. So how did this rebound effect, this change in what's going on online, change the extent or the type of the public protests that we saw?
First, let me say that we cannot relate online radicalization and street violence at the individual protester level. This is unfortunate for our study, but we tend to view this caveat as a good thing for civil liberties. In France, the vast majority of protesters are not trackable and they cannot be followed over time. However, we can at least follow online discussions over time, and we are able to show that online mobilization first became more radical through the radicalization of existing discussants and then through the departure of the moderates. And this pattern is quite consistent with the prediction of our model.
Yes.
And with what we know happened in the very days and weeks following the first blockades. Street protests soon became quite violent. I don't know if you remember
I remember.
A couple of weeks after November 17th, so on December 1st, the Arc de Triomphe in Paris was vandalized. 2,000 people were arrested, tanks were mobilized. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was pretty crazy at the time. But so those protests soon became quite violent and they remained so. But the number of protesters, as registered from different sources, both official and unofficial, like the one that was actually used by the own Yellow Vest monitoring system. So this number of protesters quickly subsided and never went back to the heights that we saw at the very beginning.
We all have causes that we believe in quite strongly and that we would be inclined to protest about, but I think most of us would prefer that for these causes, this drift to violence that you found in your model and you've fitted to what's happening in the real world did not occur. Is there any way for organizers or indeed those early participants to control this?
Well, you're perfectly correct. A drift to radicalism can kill a cause. To quote Dr. King in his I Have a Dream speech, we must not allow our creative protest to degenerate into physical violence. So this is a concern that's quite longstanding. Mm-hmm. Organizers of protests are aware of this risk, and they usually try to set up their own security service to monitor the participants on top of very likely ethical concern, for instance, in many cases. In our view, this is a good idea if they are trying to create long-lasting campaigns to force substantial policy changes on the government. But of course, there is a risk that peaceful protests will not be seen as a threat by those in power. And so there's kind of an efficiency trade-off here between the longevity and the intensity of protests.
Mm-hmm.
We don't really tackle this trade-off, but we think it's interesting. It could be explored in future work.
Now, on the other end, governments, we saw this in the Arab Spring, for example, try to control protests now by cutting internet access. Does your model tell us when this would be effective?
Yes, it can be a little bit informative about that. It's true that faced with social unrest, governments may be tempted to shut down the internet or at least access to some platforms.
Mm-hmm.
Even democratic governments, that happened very recently in France, once again, in the overseas territory of Nouvelle Caledonia.
Oh, yes.
In last spring, where TikTok was shut down for some time. And so the hope is definitely to prevent the population from being able to plan the next wave of protests. And in theory, this can certainly work. It's kind of intuitive. However, if you look at the data, you see many cases where shutdowns were actually followed by an escalation of the momentum of pre-existing protests, or at least a continuation of past dynamics. We argue that timing is key. Shutting down online mobilization once the protest has started may actually prevent protesters from gathering the very information that would otherwise have led to the natural extinction of the protest. And so you can basically prevent radical protesters from being able to coordinate so that they will keep protesting peacefully for a longer period of time. And of course, this is in addition to a possible retaliation effect of the shutdown itself.
Having studied this now, Benoit, do you believe that social media is a wonderful asset that's good for free speech, or is it a dangerous channel that's creating violent conflict?
Well, I would argue that a lack of content moderation on social media is not a sufficient condition for free speech. It very much depends on what you put behind the term free. Participants in online forums may be influenced by how the platform structures discussion. In our study, for example, we show evidence of algorithmic bias in favor of more radical comments, which are highlighted by Facebook's own recommendation system. So in many cases, discussants may be overwhelmed by the discussion itself. They begin to take positions that may not truly reflect their core views. That said, the usual disclaimer applies. Our analysis does not contain normative statements on the social value of social media. As every human-made innovation, it will become what we make of it.
That's fascinating, Benoit. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Tim.
If you want to read more about it, then the paper is called The Life Cycle of Protests in the Digital Age. It is discussion paper 19355 at CEPR. The authors are Pierre Boyer, Germain Gauthier, Yves Le Yuanc, Vincent Hollet, and Benoit Schmutzblock.
This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. If you have an opinion about this or any other episode in the series, let us know on social media, on Instagram, on Facebook, or on X. We read all of your comments. Next week on Vox Talks, when governments react to crop failures by banning food exports, who are the winners and losers?